Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, live from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn on this last day of July. You have tuned into the Farm Report, and I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. And today we're going to be talking blueberries. Tis the season. We are on the line with Ed Flanagan. He's the CEO of Wymans of Maine. Ed, welcome to the show.
Hi, Erin. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm excited. You know, I haven't done a blueberry episode in a while. For folks who want to hear some more kind of history on the blueberry, check out episode 182. Because today, Ed, I really want to learn a little bit more about the work you guys are doing up at Wymans. But before we get into that, I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Kaizen. The Japanese discipline of leaning towards sustainability in all things you do. Can you tell me a little bit about where that idea came about and how it works for you at Wymans?
Yeah, sure. Well, interestingly enough, I mean, the Japanese have taken the concept of continuous improvement, which is their term for that is Kaizen, which is K-A-I-Z-E-N in English. And they have basically adapted it. Actually, it was a post-war, World War concept that was introduced by an American named W. Edwards Deming. He was part of MacArthur's Reconstruction team, and he instituted it into their production. And so, like Toyota, for example, became the masters of it. And it really has permeated, you know, the whole Japanese culture. And we do a lot of business with the Japanese, and we're proud of that. And they are very demanding. No matter how well you did last year, they want you to do better this year, whether it's removing more stems or making the size more uniform, which is pretty difficult to do. Whatever it is, they want you to do better. And so that's the concept. I mean, it seemed to me like a pretty good way to go about our business. And if we could please the Japanese market, then the other markets were just that much easier.
Japanese always leading, always pushing us forward. Well, now the Wymans has been around since 1874. You guys operate in Maine, harvesting berries from over 10,000 acres. And I wonder if you can just briefly for us give folks kind of a rundown of the difference between the wild blueberries and the cultivated blueberries that you guys focus on.
Sure. Well, wild blueberries are one of North America's three native fruits, along with Concord grapes and cranberries. And so they've been here since basically the glaciers receded. That's why they tended to you know, to find their home in the sandy glacial soil of Maine and a good bit of the Maritime provinces and parts of Quebec. So they are different than the cultivated blueberries that your consumers would be familiar with in the fresh produce aisle because they're smaller. But in terms of how they're grown, they are a root system as opposed to a crop that's planted. So they're either there or they aren't, and they don't transplant. So in a way, they're more like a mineral resource than they are a crop. But you know, we're glad to have them, and so they tend to like the same soil that pine trees like, an acid soil, and so. Over the years, it was first the Native Americans that used wild blueberries for a host of things other than just food. They used them for medicines, and, you know, I guess what we've learned about the health benefits of blueberries lately is they knew what they were doing way back then. But one of the things they also did was they noticed that blueberry plants, perform better in ground that had suffered from fires. And so they took up the practice of burning the land. And what, in effect, that did was it basically killed the competing vegetation, a fire like that. But it didn't hurt the blueberry root. So the blueberry root then the next year would have a chance to thrive and lead to a better crop. So that practice continued on, you know, for quite a long time. Probably about the 80s, we started to wind out of burning fields because, well, your neighbors didn't like that so much anymore.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah, and it got very expensive to use the type of oil that, got that job done the best. So now what we do is we mow our fields with these fine mulching mowers, and because it's a thin sandy soil to begin with, and I'm speaking Maine now, we leave that mulch on the ground.
So, the actual berries themselves are smaller. The bushes that they grow on are smaller. And I think it's so interesting to me that like you either have wild blueberries or you don't, which kind of circles us back, I think, in some ways to the Japanese, who are always kind of like fascinated by, site specific terroir based products. I mean, there's something kind of cool about the fact that blueberries are so wild blueberries are so tied to place, and that means I think you know they're a resource that you have to go a long way to protect and to manage. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit in broad strokes. Now, you guys use the integrated pest management systems. Your berries are not organic or certified organic. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how you go about the management practices and how you deal with other things that are going to be competing with the berries from a pest or a weed standpoint?
Sure. Well, a couple of distinctions about wild versus cultivated that I didn't make in my prior remarks is that, of course, a wild blueberry is much smaller. It's about three times smaller than a cultivated blueberry. And generally, the flavor of a fruit is basically condensed around the skin. And so, you know, in a handful of wild blueberries, you're going to get more flavor than you would in a handful of cultivated for that very skin-to-pulp ratio. But the other functional difference between wild and cultivated, cultivated blueberries were developed, the Rutgers University research station, and basically they were designed from wild blueberries to grow tall and have a crop every year. We have a crop, we've learned way before my time, that the best wild blueberry crop is a field that crops every other year. So we're now up to 12,000 acres that we farm. So every year we're cropping 6,000 acres and the other six are, sprouting. But wild blueberries, and this, gets into some of the health properties and all, wild blueberries grow very low to the ground. It's what makes them a beautiful harvest to see. Difficult for us, but beautiful, for visitors. They only grow about 12 inches from the ground, and so the harvesting is a little bit difficult. And I like to explain, to people that, wild blueberries didn't develop their health characteristics for us. They developed them to basically survive in a wet, cold climate 12 inches from the ground. So we get the we happen to get the benefit of that. And let's see, Aaron, I'm going through a long answer here, and I'm not sure I'm answering your question. Was I?
Oh, well, so I was just talking a little bit about kind of management practices from like a pet.
Yes.
Yeah, because one of the things I want to talk about in the second half of the show is a work that I know is really close to your heart, looking at the colony collapse disorder and the plight of bees. But before we get into that, I want to just get a little bit of a sense of, how you guys are kind of managing the health of the blueberry crop and where some of those kind of critical decision points come up and where maybe Wyman's is the same or different than other players in the industry.
Yeah, well, about the question, why aren't we organic? It ties into basically that growing low to the ground in a wet, cold climate. it basically is something that, using that Japanese concept of Kaizen, what farmer wouldn't want to really grow an organic crop? You can get a heck of a lot more money on the market for it. But there just are some crops that don't lend themselves well to it. And wild blueberries is one. You know, here in Maine or in the Maritimes, you can get a very, very cold, wet spring, and funguses and blights can happen in a matter of 48 hours. So that's something that, when that happens, you have to treat for it. And in a lot of agriculture now, we're dealing with this little insect that's come across from China called SWD, which is spotted-winged Drosophila. And that's another one where, you know, once that infestation takes place, it can be very hard to control. In fact, it's not the the small organic farmers in New England for quite a hard time. So what we do basically is we did the Wild Blueberry Association and industry adopted really in the 80s. I guess we didn't really know we were early on this, but it turns out I've learned that we are. And we adopted integrated pest management. And when you think about it, it seems very common sense and logical. Basically, it means that you don't go spray a field because it's May 15th and it's time to spray it. You basically put some test strips out in your field, sticky paper, and you have scouts that are constantly going from field to field, and they're looking to see what type of insects are trapped on those on that paper. And if it reaches a certain density, then that tells you, well, this field needs to be sprayed. So, you know, when the industry went to IPM, that really reduced pesticide use almost 75%.
Wow.
And that not only is that what our consumers wanted to see us trend toward, but it saves farmers a lot of money, too. That was a natural evolutionary step for us to go to IPM. And again, because we're a high acid food, the blueberry is tough. It doesn't need a whole lot of chemical protection. It's just that when something erupts, you have to basically take care of it quickly. So that's how we introduced IPM into the business. We really see organic farming almost like in that concept, the Japanese concept of Kaizen. I mean, that is something that, we aspire to. We would like to get to that point someday where we absolutely need no preventive chemicals. And, you know, every year we set the goal of, we look over what we did last year, the fields that we had to spray. I mean, you know, just basically our business is like, it's like all businesses, it's becoming very data-driven. So we are capturing all of the records, and now we can put them in basic spreadsheet files and analyze them for the learnings that might come out of it. And the goal is always to get by with less.
Yeah, and be able to have that data to make better decisions. Well, the blueberry season is short, it's intense, and that brings up some issues as it regards to your, labor supply. If the, vast majority of your kind of harvesting and production is happening in a certain chunk of the year, how do you manage that flow of labor when you're really only needing people for maybe a 2.5 month period?
Oh yeah, well, you could probably do a whole show on that. migrant labor is very difficult in this country now, and there are most of the crops in America, well, you just couldn't bring them in if we didn't have a good healthy migrant workforce, and so we really want Washington to get over its infighting and come up with an immigration reform bill that gets farmers the help that they need. But, within that reality, it used to be when I started with Wyman's in 93, most of the high school kids around here made their summer money raking blueberries or working in the factories. But, slowly but surely, the kids don't want to do that type of work anymore. And so, and the same thing with, the adults. I mean, it, it basically everybody is looking for full-time work. And so, you know, we employ as many people full-time as we certainly can, but we just have, it's just the way crops go. You have this huge surge, you know, in your harvest month. And so, yeah, we basically, our tactics, you know, are to make sure we pay well. Picking blueberries in Maine or working in the Maine Wild Blueberry Factory, that's as far from the border of Mexico as you can get. So they just aren't going to make that journey unless it makes economic sense for them. So, you know, and it's not just what you pay them. It's how you house people. You know, it's the services we provide. We have a couple of cantinas that are basically, you know, we give them the space in our migrant compound. We subsidize their cooking gas, and you know, they put pretty good meals out there. You know, it's up to the migrants. To every fifth cabin is a kitchen, so they can either buy their own food and cook it in our kitchens, or you know, eat at the two cantinas. So, you know, how you treat people, the word spreads, and so we've been lucky to, in these difficult times of hiring migrant workers, we've been able to keep our factories and our fields up to capacity.
Yeah, and I think that is, so you're hitting on a real kind of challenge that agriculture is facing, and some of the kind of real issues that I think general consumers need to, and myself, of course, become a little bit more educated on how that labor flow works and where we can, you know, lend our voices to shaping a food system that we can all feel really proud of. I'm curious, you know, you guys started out, well, I guess like way back, the Wyman's was originally a canning operation. Is that right? Like, and then,
yeah.
So then there was obviously the transition to blueberries. And then at some point you started looking around and feeling the need to, you know, expand your offering into other fruits. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about what prompted the expansion from blueberries to other berries and mango.
Oh, sure. Well, yes, Jasper Wyman started the business in 1874 as a seafood canner. Millbridge, Maine, where we're headquarters, was like a lot of the villages and small towns on the East Coast. There was a cannery probably every fifth or sixth town. But he quickly realized that the wild blueberries that were available inland by the matter of, you know, 10 miles, were, you know, going to be a better long-term prospect for him. So probably by the turn of the century, we were more a blueberry company than a seafood cannery. But skipping ahead up to the 90s, what we were through the mid-90s was just a wild blueberry company. And as we look to spread our wings and go to the retail and the food service channel of distribution instead of just the industrial sale channel, we encountered, you know, the same question by buyers, which is, you know, gee, you got anything else? And as it turned out, you know, wild blueberries are what we do. But, you know, as far as buying wild blueberries, if you were a Sysco buyer for the food service industry, or if you were a grocery buyer, it's one of many fruits that they have to carry. So, you know, we realized that if we could solve more of those problems, I mean, a frozen food buyer's got to buy a heck of a lot more frozen French fries than he does frozen blueberries. So if we could bring him in his cranberries and his raspberries and his blackberries and strawberries, then, you know, then we could solve more problems for him under one roof. And so, you know, that required leaving Maine and going where we could get those other fruits. And, you know, the Pacific Northwest used to be a wonderful source, and it still is, for raspberries and blackberries. But it's been hard for that crop to grow because of all of the, the immigration issues and land pressures and things like that. So we started buying fruit in Chile back in the late 90s. And we, you know, started with one container of raspberries, and now I think we're bringing in about 200 containers from Chile every year, and it really has become a big part of our sales profile, are these other fruits. And what happened for us that was, you know, pretty good luck was right about the time that that blueberries were becoming, you know, regarded as a healthy food was just about the same time that people started drinking smoothies. And so, you know, since our crop is totally frozen and since we do business as a frozen fruit company, smoothies and frozen fruits really go hand in hand with each other. So we've really been able to ride both the health story between the health story on berries and the consumer popularity of smoothies, you know, into a lot of our growth.
Yeah, I know. That's like so hard for me to imagine that it wasn't until, you know, the early 90s that people looked at blueberries as a health food, and then the rise of smoothies as well. It seems like, I don't know, something that I definitely grew up with and just assumed was kind of always around. Well, Ed, we're going to take just a short station break, and when we come back, I want to tuck into a little bit of bee talk. So hang tight. We'll be right back.
Sure.
You are listening to Snow Mine, Piece of Your Pie.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hi, I'm Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. This summer, Heritage Radio Network is turning 5. Since our launch in 2009, we've continued to bring you food and culture content like nobody else, and we need your help. Heritage Radio Network is a passionate, grassroots, action-oriented nonprofit organization. That means we depend on the support from listeners like you to keep us alive. If you love what you hear on Heritage Radio Network, visit our website and become a member today. Thanks for listening and thanks for your support.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
And we are back. You're tuned into the Farm Report, and I am on the line with Ed Flanagan. He's the CEO of Wymans of Maine. We've been talking blueberries for most of the show. So, Ed, obviously you guys, in many ways, become stewards of the wild blueberry through your work at Wymans, but also really dependent on bees. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, I sure can, and thanks for the opportunity to do that. Aaron, while I was while you were on break, I was listening to your sponsor, Fairway Markets, and I'd like to give a shout-out to them. They carry the whole Wymans line, and I'm so thrilled when I'm visiting my son in Manhattan to walk into that Fairway store and see all the Wymans products. So thank you, Fairway.
Oh, man, they're great. Longtime sponsors of the network.
Yeah, that's great. Well, okay, so the honeybee. Wymans had gotten involved in sustainability back in 2005, I think, is when I joined the Sustainable Food Laboratory. And you know, and that was because we were wrestling with this concept of organic foods and the fact that we weren't organic, and the consumer was perceiving that as the high ground, and I thought that Wymans was much better than the average farm. So, you know, we were looking for a way to really define that ground in between, and sustainability made all the sense in the world. And so, you know, we have been good practitioners of that, both in our environmental practices and our community involvement and practices with our employees and seasonal labor. But when the honeybee issue came up, it really just cried out for special attention, and it really scared me. The unwitting discoverer of colony collapse disorder is our largest beekeeper, and I have dinner with him whenever he's up here, and he was explaining to me how he was inspecting his hives in Florida one day, and all of a sudden, instead of dead bees on the out around the perimeter of the hive, indicating that there was a problem, he looked in, and there were no dead bees. There were no bees at all, and so it was a real mystery. And he pointed me on to Penn State, which has a wonderful entomology department, and so we started to just contribute to their their cost of doing their research, it was one of those things, the environmental community, or I guess in many areas now, we talk about stakeholders. And I used to think that stakeholders were people that wanted to stick their nose in your business, whether you wanted them to or not.
Oh, geez.
But really, a stakeholder is Wyman's in the honeybee issue, for sure. I mean, we're out of business if there are no honeybees to put in our fields. And so, that got me very, very interested. And so we have gone about it two ways. We joined the Pollinator Partnership, which is an organization based in San Francisco that does a lot of the publicizing of the issue, whether it's monarch butterflies or European honeybees. But there's really, we had to basically, I think, begin to listen to our beekeepers that were serving us in Maine, but then on Prince Edward Island, where we have our own farmland and growers, that island had quarantined itself from the importation of bees out of fear of all of these troubles that the honeybee hives are having. So we had to get in the business of being a beekeeper. So we have about 1,500 hives and a very good beekeeper up there. And so we learned firsthand how you can come out of a winter and lose 50% of your hives up there. And so we've really I think been partners with the beekeepers here, in the solutions. We understand that a very big suspect in all of this is the family of pesticides called neonicotinoids, And so Wyman's forswore using, but we never did use them, but they were the new trending alternative. And so we just felt, well, if the beekeepers have so much reservation about it, then we better just hold off on that. And so the research goes on about it. We basically do support the Pollinator Partnership. The other research that we've done is with the University of Maine, where we are testing the hives when they arrive on our land, and we're testing them for the presence of diseases, viruses, pesticides. We basically are testing for the presence of, I think it's like 125 different pesticides. So, these bees have come to us from somewhere. And before that, from somewhere, and before that, from somewhere. It's a real migratory path that they're on from the start of, from middle of January till they get to us. So basically, we're doing a complete physical on the hive when it arrives, and then we're doing a complete physical on the hive when it leaves. And this, of course, is something that we've just turned over to the University of Maine to do. And we're hoping that we'll see, we're hoping that we'll see no difference. In other words, that nothing's happened to them negatively while they've been on Wyman's land. But, the book has to be open. Every basic user of honeybees has to wonder if they're part of the solution or part of the problem. So, we're, I think, humble enough to know that we need to look at all these things and be an energy source for, solving it. I mean, we're not, we are just Wyman's. Our footprint is only so big, but we have a role to play here. So,
yeah, and well, no bees, no berries, right?
No bees, no berries. That's right.
And just to clarify for folks who may not be familiar, so the bees are coming to you for a specific period of time during your season, and they're essentially you're setting up hives across the land that you're actively farming, and then after another period of time, the bees kind of get packed up and they get brought to another farm, another piece of land. They kind of follow this migratory pattern as well, correct?
Yeah, the whole season starts with the almond crop in California. I mean, that's the big daddy of all honeybee-requiring crops. And so most of America's honeybees wind up out there in the month of January. And then they just, you know, that's a long way for a honeybee to have to travel. And then they start, you know, making their way back on the semi. And every once in a while, one of them tips over. You know, one did in Delaware, I think, this year.
And
causes quite a news story. But, you know, they stop at other crops along the way, from apples to peppers and all. And then from us, I think they move on to cranberries and pumpkins and things of that sort. So yeah, and, you know, the interesting question, I mean, this is a very complicated problem, and I think that that our own personal persuasion to people is, you know, let's just do the research and wait and see, and let's not jump to neonicotinoids or the varroa mite, which is a little insect that's almost like the deer tick and Lyme disease to humans. The varroa mite can wreak a havoc, you know, in a honeybee hive. And so I think we've got to wait. It could be, you know, a honeybee's life cycle is only about, I think I'm right, if there's a beekeeper listening, he might say I'm crazy, but I think like a honeybee is only going to live 35 to 40 days. So, you know, when you think about it, when they're out there in almond country, it's almost a whole generation that turns over while they're in almonds. And so, you know, think about us as humans if we only had one thing to eat for most of our life, and that was almond nectar and pollen. And so, you know, we think like as we've become a big sort of monocrop country, that we're not really doing the best thing that we can for the honeybees. I mean, they're eating all they're surviving on almond byproduct for a while. Then, you know, when they're up here in blueberries, our lands are big, broad acres, and there's not a whole lot else for them to forage on when they're here. So I think, you know, that's a little bit of the problem as well.
You're looking, being able to, examine the infrastructure and make some decisions based on real facts and real data. Well, if folks want to find out more about the honeybees and follow that organization that Ed pointed out, it's www.pollinator.org. Ed, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Aaron. I'm always happy to share the plight of agriculture. We need good shows like yours, just letting people know that it's not easy out here.
Well, thank you. Thanks a lot. I'd hope to have you back soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
For folks who want to learn more about the work that they're doing up at Wyman's, check them out at www.wymans.com. If you're in the Northeast, hop into your freezer section at your local Fairways and grab a bag, but you can also find them in freezer sections across the country. And if you want to learn a little bit more about the blueberry world, definitely tune into episode 182 of the Farm Report. I sat down with Dave Yarborough, who's an instructor at the University of Maine, and we talked through a ton of more great blueberry information, so you can definitely get your fix this summer on the blueberries. Thanks again for tuning in to the Farm Report. This show, like all 35 of our live weekly programs, is available for free. You can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher Smart Radio, but we hope you'll visit the website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. We are a member-supported organization, so if you believe in our work, please click that Donate tab and become a member today. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.